Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I'm a writer of science fiction and fantasy and a reviewer of books and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is my co-host, Carl.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I like to write on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture.
And we have two guests with us today. We have William.
Hi, I'm William. I write, edit, and write about Mormon literature.
And we also have Ivan.
Hi, I'm Ivan Wolf, and I do book reviews, philosophical analysis of literature, teach English at Arizona State University, and compete in Highland Games, which I will be doing this weekend in Tucson. Although by the time anybody hears this, it'll probably be after the games.
Well, we'll hope that you can throw logs really far.
Yeah, there's a two-time world champion in my class this weekend, so the best I'm hoping for is second place.
All right. Well, today we are going to be talking about Howl's Moving Castle, Hayao Miyazaki's 2004 film adaptation of the Diana Wynne Jones fantasy novel. This whimsical yet intense animated film is about Sophie, a young woman turned old by a witch, and her adventures with the vain young sorcerer Howl, who lives in a moving castle. But first, our best book segment, where we each recommend something we are watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation today is a book called The Thursday Murder Club by Richard Ostman. I read this with my local book club for our Halloween pick. It is absolutely delightful. I heard the premise and I knew it was going to be for me. So it's set in a retirement community, a wealthy retirement community in England. And it's about this group of old people who get together in the rec room on Thursdays and solve cold cases. And it's hilarious. And then a real murder happens near them. And so they get all entangled in trying to like really solve the murder. And it is absolutely delightful. And I wanted to recommend it in this episode because it also has some themes in common with Howl's Moving Castle in that it's a lot of it is a commentary on aging and the way that we treat old people as if they're worthless or less competent, the difficulties of being old and how it's the same and how it's different from when you're young. So I really enjoyed this little murder mystery book. There's definitely all the trappings of a murder mystery, so you can expect some blood and gore and some violence, but it's quite fun. I highly recommend The Thursday Murder Club. Carl, how about you go next?
So something that I have watched and enjoyed recently over the past couple of weeks has been a short series on Disney Plus for those of us who are Star Wars fans, The Tales of the Jedi. It's just six episodes. Each one is about maybe 15 to 20 minutes long. And they tell a series of stories about Ahsoka, for those of you who don't know who that is, Anakin Skywalker's apprentice, before he turns dark side and goes all full Darth Vader, and shows her development. And it also follows along with the development of Count Dooku, going from a Jedi Master who eventually turns Sith Lord. I think they're both fun. This isn't, I think, that reaches the heights that Star Wars could reach, but I enjoyed seeing both of their sort of development of these two characters, and the Dooku stuff I particularly found interesting to see someone who, in this truth and justice and all the sort of Jedi virtues, but getting caught up in the problems inherent in having a democracy and the possible corruption that occurs because of the political situation he finds himself in, and then turning slowly more and more evil in trying to fix that, is a story that seems oddly relevant to current American political discourse in a variety of ways. The Tales of the Jedi on Disney Plus, not super great, but I had fun watching them. And if you like anything Star Wars related, you will too.
There you go. We'll go to William.
So I'm going to give two recommendations because I always like to provide a Mormon literature one and one that's not. And so the first will be The White Mosque by Sophia Samatar. Some listeners may know Sophia Samatar's name from her science fiction and fantasy work. Her debut novel, A Stranger in Alondria, won a lot of awards and was very well reviewed and is a book I love a lot. She just published a new book. It's called The White Mosque. And I think I'm just barely into it, so I can't say for sure, but I think it's going to be a lot of interest to Latter-day Saint readers as well. Because Samatar, her father was a Somali scholar, and her mother is a Swiss-German Mennonite from North Dakota. So she has this very interesting and unique background in which she views religion, America, all sorts of topics. And The White Mosque is technically a memoir, but it also includes travelogue and history. And it is about a group of Mennonites who thought the millennium was going to happen, and they migrated from Central Europe to Central Asia and built this church and waited for the Messiah to come. And this church is now called the White Mosque. And a few years ago, Samatar did a travel study journey along this pilgrimage to what is now called the White Mosque, along with other Mennonites. It was led by a Mennonite. So it's kind of like a Book of Mormon tour or like an Israel tour. And took a bunch of notes. And so she's writing about all aspects of her kind of background and from both sides of her parents. And so I'm really looking forward to it, to dipping more into it. Her writing is beautiful. And then I got to bring in a Mormon literature recommendation. And so I'm on the second book of the Cutting Man series, which is by DJ Butler and Aaron Ritchie. Now, Dave Butler is LDS. Aaron is not, but they co-write these books about a Mormon guy named Hiram who helps the church with problems that require folk magic, is the best way to put it, I think. And the books can get, at least the first book towards the end, it gets a little horror-ish, a little gory. Not like crazy, but you know, it's definitely PG-13. However, it is fascinating. And I just started the second one, which I think is called The Jupiter Knife. And already it's awesome. The Jupiter Knife takes place in the Moab area. So if you're interested in Utah and Mormon folk magic, definitely check out the Cutting Man books.
I have read the first one and can testify it is super interesting, something you probably haven't seen done before and done pretty well. Okay, Ivan, we're up to you.
Okay, so here, I'll show it. This is what I'm reading right now. It's The Shadow. I'm a huge, ever since a kid, I've been a huge fan of the old Shadow radio serials. And recently I read a Doc Savage, like a modern writer doing some old pulp Doc Savage, and he had a crossover between Doc Savage and The Shadow. And so that made me think, I really should go read like the old Shadow pulps. And so this is from a thing called Nostalgia Ventures, where they've been reprinting a lot of the old Shadow pulp stories. And so right now the first one I'm reading is called Crime Insured, and it's about insurance for criminals. It's hardly high literature, but it's really, really fun, and it moves at a brisk pace, and so I'm really enjoying it. So that's where I am right now.
Okay, we're going to move into our main discussion, which is about Howl's Moving Castle. I love this movie. It's one of the first anime films I saw and got me into the Hayao Miyazaki, Studio Ghibli stuff. William, you pitched this episode to us, so why don't you tell us about your relationship with the film and why you suggested this episode?
Yeah, I have long been a fan of the Studio Ghibli films, but I had not seen Howl's Moving Castle until a few years ago when Fathom Events had a showing here in Minnesota, and my daughter and I went and saw it on the big screen, and I was blown away. It was fantastic because it does all sorts of strange things that it doesn't seem like it should work, but at least for me, it does, and that has to do with the collision of magic and technology. Of there's sort of a romance story, but it's not your standard romance plot. There's a found family story, but it's not your normal found family. And it seems to be Miyazaki wrestling with some ideas that he has wrestled with in a lot of his other films, but in a way that is a little less maybe in control or a little more unleashed than we sometimes see from his other films. And so that combination altogether and just the experience of watching that with my daughter, and it has a very fond place in my heart as well.
Carl, had you seen this movie before? You're the only one who I'm not sure if you saw it before.
Watched it probably, 15 or 16 years ago. I watched the English dub, which this time I watched the original Japanese with the subtitles. And it was fun to watch it with my 6-year-old daughter, who apparently can read subtitles fast enough now to keep up on the plot. And so that was interesting. But I'd seen it before, but I had forgotten so much of it that it was me going into it again to rewatch it for this podcast episode. And I am glad that I rewatched it because I remember not liking it when I watched it the first time. And I can still tell that this particular Studio Ghibli offering is, I can tell this one's not my jam as much as some of the others that I've enjoyed over the years. But I'm glad that I rewatched it because my original impression of it 15 years ago has been now modified, that I think I'm a more mature consumer of television and stories and movies and things. So I enjoyed it more than I was expecting to, given my original impression all those years ago. But it's still kind of, well, we'll get into some of my criticisms of it, but I can see why people would like it. I did not as much. But more than I did originally, so maybe next up, maybe in 15 years, I'll be like, oh, and I'll be caught up to where you, Liz, and where you, William, are with the shows.
Okay, so, yeah, I'm a big Diana Wynne Jones fan, so, like, I love her stuff. I think she's a great author, very underrated. She should have been more popular. But actually, I didn't read the book until after I saw the movie. I saw the movie when I was on it. I saw Princess Mononoke, and then I was like, I'm going to watch all the Studio Ghibli films. So I watched every single Studio Ghibli film I could find. And then after that, when I, Howl's Moving Castle was actually the last one I watched. And then it said, based on the book by Diana Wynne Jones. And I'm like, oh, a Diana Wynne Jones book I haven't read yet. So I went and got that, and I read the whole series, because there's actually a whole book, bunch of books in the series. After I read the book, I noticed there's some pretty significant differences between the book and the movie. But Miyazaki's got his vision. And so I think that's actually part of the things where maybe some people have some issues with the movie, even if they haven't read the book, is that he's like melding his vision with Diana Wynne Jones's vision, and there's some places where it doesn't quite meet up very well.
I feel like, so this film was made during the time of the US invading Iraq. And so Miyazaki really pictured it as a very anti-war film, specifically anti that war. So there is a war in the novel, but it is not anywhere near as big of a thing as it is in the movie. It's one of the prominent themes in the movie.
When I saw the movie, it actually felt to me like I hadn't read the book yet. And yeah, in the book, it's so background. It's like barely even there. But yeah, when I saw the movie, I actually felt like this war thing just doesn't seem to really fit anywhere in the story. I actually agree with the anti-war point. It didn't really feel organic to the story the way Miyazaki handled it. So from my point of view.
Yeah, in the book, there's a lot more about the plot line with her sister and her mother, who like barely show up at all in the film, and you're confused about who they are when they show up. Do you remember much about that plot line? I cannot remember exactly what the deal is. It has something to do with Sophie being very plain, because that is a very big theme.
In the book, Sophie's world is very much a fantasy world. And there are these rules about what you do if you're the first child and the second child. And there's all these tensions around that. And so it is very much about the tensions that are created by Sophie not wanting to take on the roles that she's supposed to, and then her going out and finding who she's supposed to become. And also her sister Letty has the same issues. And so there's this whole long plot with her sister as well that takes place in the book.
Yeah, there's like stuff about role switching and taking somebody else's place and doing what they're supposed to do. Yes. And it's all big. Because Diana Wynne Jones, one of her big things is to take cliches in fantasy and turn them over. So like in fantasy, people have pretty strictly regimented roles because it's like a very medieval society. And yeah, actually in the book, like Miyazaki turns it all steampunk, Victorian stuff, where in the book, it could easily be just typical medieval European fantasy. So Diana Wynne Jones, like, tries to upset that whole hierarchies and things like that in the book, but the movie just doesn't do much with it at all.
Ivan, have you read her parody dictionary of fantasy, The Tough Guide to Fantasyland?
That's the first thing I read by her. I have both the first and second editions. Yeah, and so I was like, I've got to read more by her. The next thing I read was Dark Lord of Durkholm, where she actually made a fantasy book based on The Tough Guide.
But yeah, if you are into fantasy at all, you need to pick this up, or D&D. It's just a book full, basically a dictionary of fantasy tropes, like TVTropes.com, yeah. Only before there was TVTropes.com. It's quite hilarious.
Yes.
But I think the one thing that does stay the same, even though we've got some changing of plot lines and things, is the relationship between Sophie and Howl, and the way Sophie has to wrestle with first being the plain sister and then being old and her struggles with that. And I feel like that's the main theme of this film, is how she copes with being old and how it changes who she is and how she relates to other people, mm-hmm. and frees her from kind of the role that she's supposed to play as an eligible young woman, right? She becomes this grandmotherly figure, and so she's empowered to just speak her mind to people and do things she would never normally do because she's too shy and quiet. I find that very interesting. I don't think I've seen another film that deals with it quite that way.
Yeah, that's fun to see the trope of the old person who just doesn't care anymore because they're old and they just want to speak their mind and don't want to deal with any of the nonsense being transformed into an old person, and then just suddenly switching your personality into that way was fun and freeing to watch her get after all the different denizens of the castle for their various shenanigans as she's just cleaning up after them instead of the sort of meek, mousy hat producer that she was at the earlier stages of the film. It's just fun, and I don't know, kind of makes me wish that I could stop caring what other people thought and speak my mind more, but that's maybe it's good that we don't just jump from being young to being old-aged.
The heroism that she displays in this film is all like cleaning the castle, not putting up with someone's tantrums, going and complaining to the king, and like, there's no grand magical battle that she's a part of. She's mostly trying to avoid dying in this world of sorcerers where she doesn't have magical powers. And all of the heroism is taking care of people, cooking, cleaning. And it's so strange for that to be the central action of a book or a movie.
Yeah, that goes back to that. And when Jones, like, she's really, that's like her obsession. In fact, sometimes some of her works that I don't care for as much, she gets a little bit too invested in trying to subvert everything you could possibly know about fantasy and do something totally wildly different. But even when she doesn't succeed, I still admire her for trying. And that's one of the things, like making domestic work, like that's something maybe somebody does at the beginning of a story, not something that somebody does the whole time to the story. And like, it's how you're heroic. But that's what she was trying to go for. Like in the book, there's a whole bunch of themes about abdicating responsibility. Like in the book, Howell's actually a PhD student from Earth who's escaped to a fantasy land to avoid doing his PhD studies. So there's a whole bunch of stuff about people who are escaping. And most of that got taken out in the movie to make room for the anti-war stuff. You know, that's one reason I think the movie feels a little bit more divided to me.
So there's this domestic theme, and I think that's important, but it's a fierce domesticity. It's not a, it is a practical domesticity. It's a domestic life that also still makes room for the weird. And that's what's important about it. It is not a bourgeois domestic slot that she slots into. In fact, when Hal turns the castle into what he thinks she would like, this more kind of nicer place to live, this more kind of middle class bedrooms for everybody and nice furnishings, not too long after that, the most of that gets destroyed. And so I think this is, to me, all of this is actually the key to why Miyazaki is using this to tell an anti-war film. Because you could redo any of the World War II films that have been done by American and other filmmakers over the years to show how, or Vietnam ones, to show how war is bad. But I think what Miyazaki saw in Howl's Moving Castle is, okay, how do you... what actually needs to be changed and what is actually good about the world and interesting about the world that we can pull out that is different from the world that leads to war. And so he sets up all these contrasts between Hal and Sophie and their world and what's going on outside of the castle.
Yeah, I think something that struck me this time is very much the contrast between the hollow propaganda of all these fairy parades and just the excitement over war. Kind of reminds you of the beginning of World War I, where everyone's like, yay, a war! Now we can all prove ourselves. And then they found out how horrible it was. And then, yeah, you have that contrast of the war is dark. And it's the screen is very dark. It's very dark with explosions and it's very heavy. And Howl becomes this monster, literally, when he participates in war and in violence. And it's threatening to consume him, which great metaphor for PTSD, right? That violence does damage to you as a person. And it's hard to fight your way back to normalcy from that. I think the Book of Mormon would approve.
Yeah.
Right.
And we see that from the very beginning, where Sophie goes to visit her sister, who is working in the pastry shop, and has to dodge through all these areas where we just see, you know, men in uniform and women in dresses with parasols and nice hats that Sophie has probably made for them, or at least for some of them. And dodging through the city that is very much, we've got just, it's basically just soldiers and socialites is pretty much all that we see. And they're all hyped up about what's going to happen with the war. And she's dodging through the city and then pulling her sister away from, and finding a quiet moment to actually connect with her sister. And then, of course, along the way, we also get the weirdness that comes in, because you've got the Witch of the Waste sends her denizens after Sophie, and Howl rescues her. And all of a sudden, we leave this ferment, this patriotic ferment, and go into this magic, strange world of Howl and Sophie gliding across the city through the air. So to me, like, those themes start at the very, very beginning of the film.
For sure. And there's this aspect of, to make war glamorous, we have to put on these fake facades and parades, whereas Howl's castle is a dump, but it's wondrous and mysterious in ways that are genuine, which the war is not, which we have to make it and glorify it. Some old poetry comes to mind here.
It's fun to see, just to me, the juxtaposition of the very ordered society that you know is just is a fake. The whole thing is a Potemkin village, maybe not quite literally a Potemkin village, but, and then when the people start coming back from the war and they see the battleships that are all destroyed and all the soldiers are basically jumping immediately into the water to get on some of the local boats, the society is shown to be just lipstick on a pig. And the Howl's Moving Castle, by contrast, is shown to be more genuine and intimate and full of friendship. And this is where that theme of the found family begins to emerge very quickly. Those are where the genuine relationships are, not this other stuff that's all fake and is deliberately designed to hide the horror of what's going on. So the question is, would you rather go to war as one of the nicely dressed, smartly dressed young men on these gleaming battleships or these fantastic looking sort of steampunk airships? Or would you rather totter around the hills in Howl's Moving Castle / the Baba Yaga's hut, steampunk, whatever that is, thing? And the answer is pretty obvious. You want to go totter around in the hills in this weird random castle powered by a fire demon with a weird kid who grows a beard, and it's just, it's very bizarre, but the movie sets it up, obviously. Who would you rather hang out with? Oh, let's go hang out with the weirdos. I'm down with that.
Although the movie also, like with the book, indicates even that needs some fixing. She really has to, they need her to provide this like strong center, and Howl needs to learn to freaking control himself. He needs to learn some self-discipline and get with the program, and everybody has to learn something. In the book, I think it's a little more balanced, actually, because it's like Howl's castle needs a little bit of civilization, and civilization needs a little bit of what's going on with Howl's castle, whereas in the movie, it's more like you said, there's this really strict divide, and civilization really is just a big fake. Mm-hmm. Or the book, it's a little more balanced about like everybody could use a little bit more of each other.
I think it agreed. It's also, though, very clear that Howl's castle is not the healthiest place until Sophie arrives.
Yeah. He's literally set up a facade in town so he can like get income, but he really doesn't want to participate in society at all. He just wants to be free, is what Sophie says about him, which is interesting, because there's this way in which freedom is the opposite of war, but it's also the opposite of commitment, and which is what he learns from Sophie. He learns that he has a responsibility for these people. He can't just leave Markle at home and like Markle can't cook anything when Howl's not there. He needs to stop neglecting the people who should matter to him and commit to these people and take care of them. And that's what makes his opting out of war meaningful, finally, is that he has someone to live for besides himself. And so there is definitely this theme of becoming less selfish and realizing that the relationships that we have with other people are what makes things matter. I love the line from Sophie, who says it at the end, that a heart is a terrible burden, that learning to love people is a burden, but it's also like the only thing that makes life worth living, that keeps Howl pulling back from being a monster that eventually saves him.
It made me think of the scene because the scene is very different in the book and the movie. And so where the king is like trying to get Howl to be his magician or something. And Sophie's supposed to like, is trying to stop it. And in the book, she actually like can't say anything bad about him. She like gets all confused and starts saying nice things about him. And he actually helps out poor people and stuff like that. That's when she starts realizing he's really not all bad. He is redeemable. Whereas the movie, it's not quite the same. It's much more, Howl's not that great of a guy. But anyway.
Yeah.
First, that's just what I thought of, is that the movie really, I think, actually, although it still shows Howl can be fixed, it's a lot more, Howl's a lot more negative for the first part of the movie than he is in the book, where in the book he's still a jerk with a temper problem, but he's actually much more, I don't know, nuanced is the right word, but much more, he's much nicer and does nicer things too on the side.
Yeah. One thing that was really interesting to me, I am a big fan of Brandon Sanderson, and Sanderson is very much about turning fantasy into almost like a science fantasy where the magic has rules and we work with it like science and there are advances that are logical. And Diana Wynne Jones and Hayao Miyazaki, both of them, are very much the opposite. The magic is very like unexpected and weird and you don't know what's going to happen next and there's no way for you to understand what's going to happen next. It's very weird, which I think is the word that William used for it.
Well, that depends on which book you're reading by her. I mean, the Christopher Chant series, magic there has some very strict rules, although they're hard to understand and you usually don't realize them until in retrospect.
Right, but it's not the Sandersonian magic where it's, I'm going to explain all the elementic metals to you, and now you will figure out how to use them like a video game to solve the puzzle.
Yeah, it's not the strict logic problems that Sanderson has.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm not going to relitigate that whole debate in fantasy about which system is better, because I think neither system is bad and it really depends on the work. But a lot of the Miyazaki films have the strangeness to it and this weirdness to it. And as someone who just published a book that's literally called Strange Mormon Stories, it's The Darkest Abyss, Strange Mormon Stories, BCC Press published it. And it's all works of Mormon fiction. But to me, the weirdness is important because it allows us to strip away some of, if you buy into it, obviously, and not everybody does, but it allows you to strip away some of the political and social and cultural valences that we attach to things. And back to our previous discussion, if this was just a straight up anti-war film without kind of the weirdness and the character of Howl and the character of Sophie, I don't know that it would be all that effective, and obviously it's not going to work for everybody. But what the weirdness does is, one is it pushes back against technology. And Miyazaki is someone who's fascinated by technology, especially aircraft. That comes up over and over again in his films. But he also understands how technology can be used for evil and to destroy and to try to control. And the nice thing about weird magic or strange magic or even just strange things in general is that they resist the logic and the imposing nature of technology or even kind of modern ideologies and things like that. And for those for whom strange fiction or weird fiction works, it helps you get your brain outside of the grooves that the modern world tries to track them in. And so that's what I try to do, like, for example, with my stories, is not worry so much about whether the modern Mormon experience, like, what that needs to be and what it is for everybody, and accurately capture that. I do sometimes write what's called faithful realism, which is a little bit more straight ahead literary approach to writing about Mormons. But with these stories, it's really about, okay, we've got this rich, interesting heritage. What if we got a little strange with it and started speculating about things or taking things from a different angle? What can we learn about ourselves and about the Mormon experience? And again, like, I think that this is what Miyazaki's achievement is with this film, is, okay, there's lots of films about the horror of war. What if we meshed up that idea down to the shots of battles in the air and ships sinking and soldiers marching and a cafe full of soldiers and young women? what if we mash that up with this strange thing that I read in a book by Diana Wynne Jones? And so to me, it really works. And I think that the weirdness is that the film doesn't work without that weirdness.
I agree. Like, I think the magic kind of almost reinforces that feeling of being in a war zone, because Sophie has no powers. She has no idea what these people are capable of. And she's just trying to dodge it. Like, what happens next? And it really puts the viewer in the same place as Sophie, right? Because, you know, somebody will suddenly transform into someone else and we'll be like, oh, okay, that was a thing that they could do. And we have to just keep rolling with it the way that Sophie's having to roll with it, and the way that people living in a conflict zone just have to roll with, this is the way life is now. We got to figure out how to keep going. We have no idea what's going to happen. And I enjoy the weirdness of it. Just the little strange things that you're like, wait, how? I don't know. I love Howell's tantrum when he dyes his hair the wrong color. That kills me every time. Just like him coming down and he's just, life isn't worth living if you can't be beautiful. And he's got green goo all over him. It's just like the perfect depiction of just an absolute meltdown over nothing. I just love this picture of this green goo and there are shadows all over and you have no idea what's going to happen, but it sure doesn't seem good. And you don't have to understand it to know the feeling it's giving you.
It's not like one approach is better than the other. I like Brandon Sanderson's work. I played role-playing games with him in college. There's my geek cred. He was my game master for West End Games Star Wars role-playing. But at the same time, I really love H.P. Lovecraft stuff, type stuff. Weird fiction, weird horror. And I like the thing, like you said, where it makes us see normal stuff in weird ways. So like actually in the book, this isn't in the movie at all, but in the book, there's a scene where they go to Wales, where Howell is a PhD student. And Sophie has to try to explain what a car is. And she just have no idea what a car is. And she makes a car seem very utterly alien and strange. And I like that part in the book because it's taking something that just seems so, we just accept the fact, a car, everybody drives a car, and trying to see it from the viewpoint of somebody who has no idea what a car is, but at the same time, isn't necessarily terrified by it either. There's all kinds of room for all sorts of different approaches. And the weirdness is, I think, important to help us get outside our boxes.
And that's the beauty of this being a Studio Ghibli film, because when you're doing animation and beautiful animation, you can do things in it that you couldn't, that wouldn't work as well in other media, in other forms. And even down to one of the things that I really noticed watching it this time was how my memory of it was that we had the magic and the wizards battling each other, and we had the soldiers and the technology battling it out, and they were together but were separate. But now seeing some of those scenes where Howl's up in the sky transformed into the bird trying to battle everybody, the planes have kind of look like birds or reptiles or these strange sea monsters or creatures in the way that they're built. And then the the magical figures that he's battling look like
the blob men.
like people. And so it all just gets mixed together, and that almost makes it all the more terrifying.
Yeah. Wanted to go back, if I could, to the point that Liz was, or at least the scene that Liz was talking about, where Howell has the meltdown because his hair has changed color and he's, oh, woe is me, my life is no longer worth living. Because I was watching that with my 6-year-old daughter, and we, while that was going on, she's asking questions about why is he melting down? Why is he doing this? Why does she have to explain these things to him? And I had to have a conversation with her about, is life only worth living for pretty people? And she's like, well, no, obviously not. And so it was a fun little moment there. And something else that the animation does that I appreciated, although maybe my more logical style brain was trying to impose some meaning on it, was the fact that Sophie starts off as a young girl, gets transferred into an old woman, but then over the course of the movie, and it's not clear to me why or what the triggers are, starts becoming a young person again. Her hair never seems quite to go back. It's just, there's all sorts of different things going on. But I did like the sort of overall theme that as she comes into herself, as she helps Howell figure out his problems, acting as an unofficial therapist for him, and helps bring this family together, she's more able to undo the witch's curse, even though it doesn't seem like there's ever an explicit moment where they're like, aha, the curse has been lifted. She just grows into herself and changes, and that was something that I really enjoyed. from the movie. Maybe if I watched it more carefully and wrote notes, I could figure out exactly what the triggers are. But just the general idea that she is becoming herself as she grows into this new role at the same time was a fun little conversation to have with my daughter as we were going through.
In the movie, like the when she changes, if you go through and take notes, I think you find is that she changes back whenever she has an aha moment, basically. Whenever she comes to some sort of self-realization, like you said, she's becoming herself. That's basically it. She like has some new insight into, oh, this is who I really am, or this is what's really important about me. And then she changes, and then it goes away. But it's like, those are all signs.
Now, I think that might be a little reductive, because I think actually it's when she's not thinking about herself. Like the first time that it happens is when she's standing up for Howell. And so she's entirely thinking about not herself. And then we have the scene where Howell builds the cottage for her. And then she's focused on him and him and him. And then he says she's beautiful, and she suddenly is focused back on herself, and she immediately ages again. So I feel like a lot of it is a message of unselfishness. It almost seems like an anti-makeover movie. There's some, we all enjoy a good like Princess Diaries, right? Where someone's, oh, they're homely and ugly, and then we teach them how to take care of themselves and they're beautiful. And but there's something harmful about that. And I feel like this movie's almost the opposite of that, in that it acknowledges the pain that people have from not feeling adequate, especially in physical beauty. Like when Howell has his tantrum, and I love Sophie's reaction. She's like, how dare you? Like, I've never once in my life been beautiful. How dare you be so upset that your hair is the wrong color? And it lets her really grieve over that. Like, she literally goes out and just, like, sobs. And only after she deals with that emotion and then goes back and is like, this is just the way it is. And she accepts that. And then she's able to help Howell. And as she gradually forgets about herself and cares more about Howell, she doesn't worry about how she looks. And she turns back to herself.
I think the first time we actually see that transformation is when she's asleep, because that's who she is. This is a spell that's on her, right? And so you're right. When she's not conscious and others are not conscious of her and her female form, then she looks like who she really is. But, and so it's actually, in a sense, a mirror of Hal and his vanity. But of course he's vain, because he is someone with power who doesn't have a heart. And so they both are basically under this curse that affects their appearance in relation to the world and how they feel about that appearance. And a big part of the film is figuring out what to do about that.
And even juxtapose those two characters with the Witch of the Wastes, who, when she loses her power, becomes like a doddering old woman who Sophie then takes in and takes care of, even though this is literally the person that cursed you with old age. I think it was a marvelous little arc to see her look at this person and be like, whatever she used to be, this nice looking woman who was carried around in the little litter by the blob man. She's a little, obviously, overweight, portrayed even in her gorgeous, pretty form, but she just becomes a wreck and a mess. But they start calling her grandma, and she's making sure she's warm by the fire and is fed. And it's a nice little subplot line about forgiveness, and I think it works really well.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a multiple forgiveness, right? Because after she takes her in, then she's the one who grabs Howell's heart and destroys everything. It ruins the whole ship at the time when they're trying to go get to Howell. And Sophie doesn't yell at her. Or I try to think about all the times when my toddlers have grabbed something and I need it from them now and they cannot have it. Would I approach it the same way that Sophie did? She just goes up to her and hugs her and says, I really, really need it, please. She doesn't try to wrest it from her in any way. Just this. And that's where the pacifist message of the movie was the strongest to me. That's the point in most fantasy books where we would justify violence, being like, no, we need to win this back because it is ruining the novel. It will kill our protagonist. We need to stop this. And so violence is okay. But even at that point, violence isn't okay. Is there anything else we haven't covered that we'd like to talk about that we haven't gotten to?
I'll just plug, if you didn't like the movie, Carl, I would suggest reading the book, though, because the book is really good. And anything by Diana Wynne Jones is worth reading, I think.
Yeah, I didn't realize that I had a copy of the book until yesterday, and I just didn't have time to read an entire novel today. So I will put that on my list and get around to it. So the one complaint I had about the movie is that I loved all these individual stories and plot lines, and they all had really interesting stuff, and the symbolism is great, and the animation of the symbolism is, of course, amazing. And I just, I don't know what they were all doing together. Like, I felt any single one of them would have been interesting on their own, and they all are, but the mishmash of them all together doesn't quite jive for me. It doesn't quite work, and I don't know. At least that's how I see it.
When I first saw the movie, I felt, and I hadn't even read the book at that point, I just felt like the war stuff just seems out of sync with everything else. And yeah, thematically, there's some connections, and Miyazaki makes it more or less work. But yeah, I think the book is much more thematically unified. And the movie really was Dinah Wynne Jones is over here, and Miyazaki's over here, and they come together in the middle. And it works, but it doesn't quite perfectly match up. You don't have the singular vision of Miyazaki or Jones, you have a mixed vision.
Right. The movie that it mostly reminded me of, for those of you who have seen it, is AI, Artificial Intelligence, which was written, which is from a short story by an author, and then a film treatment by Stanley Kubrick that then turns into a movie directed by Steven Spielberg. And it is obvious to me that, like, the vision of those three very different, very artistic, very smart artists never quite came together. I don't know. It just felt a little bit like that to me.
The original short story is really not in the movie.
Sure. But that's what it felt like to me. There's a couple of competing visions, and they never quite managed to see. Because I'm okay with variations on a theme. I'm okay with adaptation and change. Movies and books aren't the same. You've got to make differences. That's fine.
I think the point where it is the worst in this movie is where Turniphead turns back into the prince, and then he has to give this huge monologue to explain who he is, because we have no idea. If you listen carefully, you can hear about the missing prince in some of the, like, background dialogue, if you listen to the English version and you can catch the background dialogue, but it's not there at all. And so you're just like, wait, who? What?
Deus Ex Turnip. I think that there's a lot more consonants than you are saying. Because especially if you look throughout the film of how the kind of the war pieces and the non-Howl's world and then Howl's world and the axis of power with the palace, if you look at how those all kind of shift around each other and then start to invade each other, I think there's a lot more, they're weaved together, I think, a lot more than maybe it seems if you're used to watching the film as the standard, here's our narrative when we're going to go from A to B to C. Standard, what's the word I'm looking for? The standard...
Just the standard, like, Hollywood formula for a film, right? Like, that standard three-act formula. It definitely isn't that. It feels a lot more like Asian storytelling typically is, where it's more of a... It feels like life, where everything isn't neat. And you're right that the things get entwined around each other, but there's no clear, like, everything drives to this point, but there are lots of things going on. So I enjoy it that way, but it is a little different. And I do think that it isn't as unified as something like Spirited Away or some of Miyazaki's more original pieces.
Again, I think that has to do with just the fact that it's an adaptation, because when you've got Miyazaki's basic pure vision, it works. But when you have to try to mesh it with a Western story, even a Western storyteller who's trying really hard to be original and do something outside the box and to subvert all kinds of tropes, it's still a Western story.
All right, we'll move on to our rating segment. We do three ratings. Our first one is for content. I don't think there's really any objectionable content in there. There is the one scene where Howl with the hair is in a bathrobe, a towel that barely covers things. You get a little glance there, but I don't think it's offensive, really.
My 6-year-old thought that was hilarious. She saw that, she's like, ha ha ha, he's naked. But I had no problem watching that scene with my 6-year-old daughter. It worked fine. It was fine.
Some of the war scenes and some of the otherworldly scenes might be, depending on the kid, a little bit too scary for younger kids. Depending on the kid, my kids would not be bothered by it. My 7-year-old would not be scared by the scary stuff, but I know other kids who would probably be very creeped out. Depending on the kid, if they're sensitive to really dark, scary stuff, or really, the war doesn't really show that much, but it is.
It's not gruesome, but it is tense.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. So I think I'd put it in Celestial myself, with the caveat that it is about war. So you're watching something intense. So you might want to be aware of that for young kids who don't like that kind of tension in their movies, and send them to watch My Neighbor Totoro, where there is no tension whatsoever.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Celestial. Just as far as there's just so little objectionable stuff that it's fine. We would play this movie in the Celestial Kingdom and it would be okay. Like, we can have that for movie night there.
I'm good with that, although our emo is going to make it into the Celestial Kingdom because Hal's pretty emo.
He is. He's so hilarious.
Oh. He's got Sophie to
That's
keep
right.
him straight.
So. Yes, yeah. yes. So then our second rating is for artistic merit on a scale of 1 to 5 popcorn balls. Who do we want to start with?
I'll start because I'm going to be the naysayer. I'm just going to give it 3. The animation is stunning. The voice acting is fun. The themes are there. I like all the individual plot lines. I'm going to give it 3, though, because those are all kind of 4s and 5s, but it just doesn't weave together as well as I'd like it to. And I understand that I don't quite understand Eastern sensibilities as far as storytelling goes, but this did not work for me the way other Miyazaki films and other anime films that I've seen have. And so I'm just going to give it 3 popcorn balls.
All right, William.
4.5. And the 0.5 is deducted because I agree that the turnip head resolution is a bit abrupt, even if it is remarked upon in various parts of the film. I think it's a more interesting achievement than a lot of other films out there, and especially a lot of other anti-war films. And I also think that the strangeness to it is both not intended to be logical, but also has some interesting thematic and visual resonances that really cohere into something quite fascinating and interesting and profound.
It's interesting that we would have to go watch the English dub to pick up on the turnip head subplot because I watched the Japanese dub this time and that just completely came out of left field for me. That's interesting because usually we say you should try to watch the dub in the original language, and it's just a rule of thumb for me, but in this case maybe it doesn't work, at least for this one subplot.
It can certainly be hard in a film if there's lots of writing or lots of background chatter, like talking over each other, that you're supposed to overhear, but there's someone talking in the foreground. It's definitely difficult to do in translation.
Yep.
Yeah. Or you get like Kiki's Delivery Service, where Phil Hartman basically changes the character completely. But then everybody complains as how they don't have Phil Hartman's track, because most of his track isn't on the English dub anymore, because in the English dub, he ad-libbed tons of just snarky lines, turned the pet into this total snark ball. But that wasn't in the original Japanese. It's hilarious, but yeah, a lot of people got upset, so they actually removed it from the DVDs. And so if you have a first edition DVD, you can hear Phil Hartman's ad-libs in the dub, but you can't hear him anymore. I would go to 4.5 balls too. Most Miyazaki films would get a 5, but just because I think because the Wynn Jones and Miyazaki just don't perfectly match up, it's a 4.5.
I would put it at about a 4 myself too. It's not Miyazaki's best work, but it's still amazing. Definitely one of my favorites. And our final rating is for Gospel Connections on a scale of 1 to 5 apricots. There's lots of interesting themes to talk about here, I think.
I would say on my first watch, I would have said like a 4, and now I'm going to say 5, because I think that there are so many layers of themes that resonate with me and also with, I think, certain that resonate with me and with the gospel as I understand it, that I keep thinking about it. And there's not a lot of films that give me that many things to think about.
That's true. I have to agree with you. Just as we were talking here, I thought about the Book of Mormon and the Condemnation of Violence, and now I want to go back and watch it again and figure out how it fits in with the Book of Mormon perspective on the just war or not. So I would give it 5 as well. I just think there's so many different layers to this film that you could pull apart.
I'm going to give it 4, but that's because as we keep going on doing these ratings on our podcasts, I think I've agreed with the sort of theory of our third rating that 5s should be reserved for things that are more explicitly religious or explicitly Christian. This is more just morals, which is a major and important part of religion, but is not all of what religion is. So I would give it 4, but I watched this with my 6-year-old daughter and I had some really good just side conversations with her as we were going, and it was a great movie for that sort of thing. And she enjoyed the weirdness of it, and she enjoyed some of the themes, and like it worked on her. And so it was, I give it 4.
See, my issue is I can think of very little things that are overtly Christian in this form of film and television that I would give a 5. So I have to give this one a 5 because I can't apply that same rubric.
It is difficult to find the overlap between overtly religious and well-crafted, shall we say, messaging. There are very few things in that circle. We talked about Silence, right? I think Silence is in one of those itself, but I can't think of too many. You're right. Ivan, what do you think?
I'll just agree with Carl and call it that, because anything I say would just repeat what he said. So
fantastic. All right. William, where can people find you if they want to follow your writing?
I am on Twitter as @MotleyVision, and everything else you can find at motleyvision.org. Books that I've written, thoughts that I've shared on Mormon literature and culture, and I'm just wrapping up a really interesting email series, Motley Vision, the blog, which Ivan actually was part of at one point, no longer is active, but I revived it as an email newsletter, and we're just finishing up an interesting series that I've been doing looking at all the essays in Myron J. Clark, who is a BYU literature professor, called Liberating Form, that kind of meshes culture and religion in really interesting ways. So motleyvision.org.
I've been reading those newsletters, and it's always really, really interesting. You have really good insights and just such a depth of knowledge on this subject. I've loved it. And I'm 2/3 of the way through your book, The Darkest Abyss. I just finished Uncle Porter's Gun, which was very weird and very interesting. I loved it. So highly recommend picking up that book. There's all sorts of interesting Latter-day Saint and Mormon weirdness in there. Ivan, have you got anything to promo?
Not at the moment. I'm not really online much. I have a Twitter account, but mostly just to view stuff. I don't post, and I'm not on any blogs currently. So maybe in the future, maybe next time.
Go see you at any Scottish games you compete in.
Yeah, if you're going to be in Tucson November 5th, I'll be competing, but it's probably going to, this will probably be on the air after November 5th. Yeah, my next games probably won't be till like March, because they usually shut down over the winter.
I'm so fascinated to talk later about how you got involved in this.
Yeah, and how do you train for log throwing?
If you have a log, you throw it. I don't have a log, but I just general strength training, just to be able to handle the weight. It's an unbalanced weight, so just being able to training with unbalanced weights helps.
So it sounds like you compete in the caber toss.
Well, it's there's 9 events. It's either split over 2 days or it's all one day here in Tucson. It's for my classes all on Saturdays. So there's 9 events. There's heavy and lightweight for distance, heavy and light hammer, weight for height, stone, open stone, Braemar stone, which is stone throwing from a fixed position, and the sheaf toss, which is a 20-pound bag of straw.
Oh, I didn't know about that one. I've seen the stone. I've seen the caber tossing. I've seen the various stone throwing, but I didn't know about that one. That's fascinating.
So it's basically Scottish decathlon. Like, not 10, of course, but there are multiple events. And if you want to do well, you have to do all of them.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, there you go. All right, Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me at Carl Cranny on Twitter. That's where I am. I would like to plug an interview that Liz and I did on BYU Idaho Radio, their podcast. They found our podcast interesting and wanted to talk to us a little bit about it. So that went up today on November 3rd. So if you want to listen to Liz and I talk at a high level about what we're trying to do with the podcast, you can go listen to that on BYU Idaho Radio's podcast.
And now the money will start rolling in.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That's right. All the sponsors. You can find my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com. Thanks for joining us this week for our conversation. Carl, you want to give us our pitch for our next episode?
Absolutely. So our next episode is going to be released on Thanksgiving Day, which is the day you're allowed to start listening to Christmas music. So we'll be doing our Christmas episode. We are going to do a comparison of several different adaptations of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol and talk about why there are so many of them, why this story resonates with our audiences over many decades.
And why the Muppet is the best one.
Spoilers!
Oh, sorry.
I think we all know what's going to end up being the favorite, but it's going to be fun to talk about the different versions of it and what are the strengths and weaknesses of all of them. And so we plan on doing that for our next episode, and we hope you all look forward to listening to our conversation about all the different versions of A Christmas Carol.
This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. We'll see you next time.